Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is the Redbox Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times radio show. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or on your Times radio app. And if you're already listening on the radio, tell your friends. Coming up on today's episode is a cracker. It's part 4 of the political editors. Philip Webster, the longest serving of all of the politics that I've spoken to. He was political editor of the Times from 1992 to 2010. He describes getting to know Tony Blair and Gordon Brown and then chronicling their premierships. Amazing story as well about being taken hostage with Neil Kinnock. That's coming up in just a moment. But first, as we always do, let's kick off with a look at the news with today's columnists.
Manveen Rana and someone called Matthew on Times Radio.
Yes, and we say hello to Manveen Rana. Hello, Manveen.
Hello.
Nice to have you with us. And this week's Matthew, I think for the first time.
That's right.
Well, it's not the first time anyone's called you Matthew. From The Economist, Matthew Holhouse.
Hello, nice to see you.
How are you?
I'm really well. How are you?
You're very good. I've seen you for ages.
I know. We used to work next rooms to each other, didn't we, down in Parliament. So yeah. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
And then we got much sillier jobs, which required not going to the same office every day, which is much better. I suppose we should start with the story, which is all, you know, dominating the news today. The plane crash, was it crashed? Was it blown up? Was it shot down? And what the death of the head of the Wagner Group means, big picture, Matthew?
What does it mean? It means, it's really spectacular, isn't it? It's quite something. I mean, this is a rule which has always been built on the threat of violence, you know, going back to Putin's early days and threatening to wipe out Chechen terrorists and, you know, some really dreadful assassinations of journalists and politicians, people like Boris Nemtsov. But really, there's brilliant analysis by a guy called Mark Galliotti, who's a really brilliant Russia analyst in The Spectator this morning, where he argues that this really is a new era of assassination and sort of really spectacular assassination of somebody who's, the nature of Putin's rule was that he was always for a long time able to manage these sort of disputes, these internal factions through the combination of corruption, electoral fraud, and so on. And what Prigozhin's mutiny showed was that his ability to manage those disputes was falling apart under the pressures of the war. And so this does look like a really quite spectacular attempt, you know, if it indeed is an assassination, to reimpose that discipline through, you know, brutal and spectacular in public violence. I mean, Galliotti's argument is that ultimately this exposes the weaknesses in Putin's regime, and that, you know, some of the elites will be now wondering, actually, are they still safe and better off sticking close to Putin? I mean, the big picture is, you know, let's put this in context. This is all a result of the war in Ukraine. This was a war launched by Vladimir Putin. It appears in the belief that it would, you know, cement his place in history as a great Russian leader and create this sort of this perverse idea of this greater Russia, and that the Ukrainian state would disintegrate on contact. You know, it would fall apart within days and they'd install a puppet regime. Now, what's happened? The Ukrainian nation has never looked more sort of vital and alive idea. There's been a phenomenal coalescing around the Ukrainian government and President Zelensky, and it is Russia which is, you know, been thrown into chaos. We're seeing these rival factions, doubts about Putin's longevity. I mean, it's a warning from history, isn't it? About what happens if you go to war against your neighbours and the chaos you sow within your own system.
It's also what it just tells us about Putin's judgment and grip, Manveen. This didn't happen immediately after the coup. In fact, there was this sort of weird business where they sort of seemed to kiss and make up and they were going to rub along nicely and he was just going to go off and retire somewhere. For some reason, Putin suddenly decided, right, no, he's got to go now. And it just suggests, again, his sharpness, his grip, his control isn't what it was.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone sort of expected this to happen for a while, you know, from the moment that there was an attempted coup, from the moment, to be honest, even before that, when Prigozhin started quite openly insulting Putin and saying that he wasn't very effective anymore in his videos from the battlefield and looking like he was the one really running the war. You knew that couldn't go on for very long. And then you had the attempted coup. You had Putin sort of saying this was treachery, betrayal, and if there's one thing he can't put up with, it's exactly that. So it was only a matter of time, but we had this weird period in the middle. You know, if you think back to a similar circumstance in Turkey when they had an attempted coup, Erdogan immediately, within 24 hours, had locked up anyone who could have had anything to do with the coup. And as a, you know, weirdly, having almost lost power, having almost had a coup against him, came out looking stronger than ever, looking absolutely unassailable. And with Putin, you sort of had this mad circumstance where Russians were killed during this attempted coup, and yet everybody who was involved in it was allowed to walk away scot-free. There was no punishment for them at all. Prigozhin went to Belarus, and then we found out very quickly came back and had a three-hour meeting in the Kremlin, during which he was, you know, Putin very publicly said this. He sort of said he had demanded that there was a change of leadership in Wagner, and they didn't listen. So, you know, Putin looks weaker and weaker and weaker. It starts to look inevitable that something has to be done if Putin's not to look like he's completely lost control. We've had a series of incidents. Just 2 days ago, Prigozhin put out yet another video. He's on the ground in Africa on the very day that Putin is addressing the BRICS summit in South Africa, but he can't do it in South Africa because there's an arrest warrant for him from the International Criminal Court. So he's having to do it by a video link, looking quite weak. And there's Prigozhin looking vital and on the ground, and he's the one who is doing what Putin can't. There was a lot of, Prigozhin really was pushing it. There was a lot of sort of a red flag to a bull in the last few weeks. So it did feel like it was only a matter of time, but it's still spectacular that it's happened. And I'm not sure Putin looks as strong as he had hoped at the end of it.
And in practical terms, Matthew, in terms of executing the war in Ukraine, the Wagner group under Prigozhin was doing a lot of the heavy lifting. In fact, the whole point of the coup was him to say, look, we're not getting the support that we need. We're not getting the equipment. We're not making the progress and the gains that we should be making in Ukraine. So if you remove him and presumably now the Wagner group from that war effort, given that they've just lost their leader, that actually makes the ultimate aim of taking back Ukraine even harder, doesn't it?
It raises all sorts of questions, doesn't it? I mean, we shouldn't underplay just what a vile group this was. I mean, this was a group that became notorious for Wagner group was is effectively a mercenary group that was used to do a lot of the Kremlin's dirty work. So in Central African Republic and Syria, and originally raised to fight, you know, the first invasion of Ukraine in 2014. Became absolutely notorious for war crimes. Effectively, became notorious for the use of sledgehammers to kill people, to kill prisoners, including in Ukraine, linked to beheadings, all sorts of ghastly things that the Prigozhin revelled in, and it became a bit of he became a bit of a folk hero, actually, and had some support in Russia amongst this sort of nationalist faction that think the war should be prosecuted more aggressively, that think that, you know, they're fighting with one hand tied behind their back. And this is the sort of the faction that Putin has to manage now, who actually regard Prigozhin as a hero. There were messages sent out on their Telegram channel saying that, you know, we will avenge this, and this is a terrible mistake.
Yeah. And so, if anything, he's just fighting on another front. Well, we'll obviously keep across any further developments and any further facts, which are obviously quite hard to come by in this whole story. Let's come back close to home and talk about British politics now. Nadine Dorries, who I don't need to remind you, announced she was going to resign with immediate effect and then unresigned with immediate effect. And it's been going on now for 2 months, I think. She hasn't spoken.
It feels a lot longer, Matt.
She hasn't spoken in the Commons for much longer. Yesterday on the show, Tory MPs had been lining up, telling her to clear off. This was the Tory MP, Caroline Noakes, telling me that Nadine Doyle should stick to her word and resign.
Well, you know, she shouldn't have the Tory whip if she's made it plain that she no longer wishes to be a Conservative MP but can't take that final step towards resignation. I think she needs to crack on and do that.
And then Damien Green, former Deputy Prime Minister, also said she wasn't doing herself any favours by hanging on.
Well, I think, Nadine has said she's going to resign immediately. Then do it. I think it's from her point of view. I mean, despite the fact I've had many political differences with Nadine over the years, but as a person, I like her a lot, and I just think she's not just damaging Parliament, she's damaging her own reputation as well. I think having said she's going to go, it would be in everyone's interest if she just went.
Well, she did then finally, we did hear from her, she sent a statement to the News Agents podcast saying, "Myself and my team of 4 caseworkers are working daily with constituents. I understand that political opponents such as Labour-run Flitwick Town Council are choosing the summer and the news-hungry outlets in the summer recess to be noticed. However, we are just getting on with the work." And going to war with one of your own town councils seems quite extreme. We did actually ask Nadine if she'd like to come on. We haven't heard back. Any idea where she is, Matthew?
You know, it's quite something when, you've got Conservative MPs deciding that it would actually be better to have a by-election against the Lib Dems in a pretty safe heartland Conservative seat when you're 20 points behind in the polls than have Nadine Dorries around any longer. I mean, that's what you might, that is a lose-lose situation. Yeah. Oh, it's bad. So Stephen Bush has a very good column, I think, in the FT, where he, a bit of uncharacteristically tabloid turn, refers to Rishi as rubbish Rishi. And he says the problem with Rishi Sunak isn't that he's too soft or too aggressive or too this or too that. He's just comes across as kind of ineffective, and that there's a whiff of decay and ennui, and, it's time just to sort of tuck him up. If there was sort of one symbol of the idea, which will be very powerful at the election, that these guys are basically done and they've had 13 years and it's time for a change, the fact that you've got Nadine Dorries basically not doing very much and her own MPs calling it Dorries, it's just that sense that it might be time to move on. That's very dangerous for them.
Yeah, and Manvin, it was interesting actually. We spoke to Henry Hill from Conservative Home earlier in the week, and because people said, well, what could Rishi Sunak do? Well, it turns out he could just lay a motion in the House. It's not used very much. In fact, it's only been used since the 1950s. But you could just lay a motion in the House and MPs would vote to expel one of their colleagues. And you can't think, we've sort of reached the point now where, and actually, I mean, it might even help Rishi Sunak in the by-election if he could go and say, look, I knew you weren't being represented, so I got rid of her so you could have a Tory MP instead.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think Matthew's right. It would just make him look more effective, which he doesn't here. And, you've got this, this weird position where it's not even Labour who's calling for her to go, quite as loudly as it is the Tories. You had two of them on yesterday. This morning, you have Nick Gibb doing the rounds, supposedly talking about GCSEs. And there is a very serious issue he should be talking about. Everybody's asking him about Nadine.
Yeah.
I think he managed to say, I just think people should do what they say they're going to do. And I think that is actually key, because she sort of becomes this albatross for the party where everyone looks at her as a prime example of how politicians, the Tory party, whatever, don't do what they say they're going to do. To go into another election with her and then to, hear any promises and sort of think, well, you're going to stick by them, it's just very unconvincing.
Yeah, the mistake was her to say that she was going to resign immediately and then not.
But I'm also terribly entitled and, a bit out of touch, because, she's clearly put her constituents last in all of this. This is all about why she didn't get a peerage. And I think that's quite hard to sympathise with.
Yeah, the fact that several people have pointed this out, but she's no longer describes herself as a Conservative MP for
Does she not?
Bedfordshire on her Twitter account. She's just recovering Secretary of State, Sunday Times bestseller, Talk TV Friday night with Nadine, 8 p.m, although not at the moment. We've not seen her in the building. And a Daily Mail Tuesday columnist. And then the email address is for her agent, not for her constituency office.
Phenomenal.
So there we are. Now, let's turn our attention to the important question of Rishi Sunak's pin-up. We've got some details of the artworks that senior politicians have hung on their wall. James Hill from The Spectator has got the inside track and joins us now. Hi, James.
Hi, Matt.
So just take us through it then. What do politicians have on their walls?
Right, so this is a free information request to the House of Commons. And basically, obviously, ministers get two offices in Westminster and Whitehall, one in their ministerial office, but also one in their parliamentary office. And it's great because it means that finally you can see actually what the shadow cabinet hang on their walls as well. And basically, the parliamentary art collection, meant to be kind of a sort of great artwork from the nation's, sort of half the nation's legislature, and where they occasionally add paintings to them. So if you walk around Portcullis House, you'll see more modern politicians like Diane Abbott, Tony Blair, have pictures up, for instance. But really, looking at this, I think I was struck mostly by how sort of uncreative they all really were. I mean, mastering, as I say in the article, is mastering the art of politics is one thing, but the politics of art is quite another. And I think the most intriguing one was Ed Miliband's selection of Keir Hardie, a picture of Keir Hardie to hang in his office, perhaps a reminder of Labour's past at a time when some fear they're moving to the right.
So take us through some of that. I mean, the one that stands out seems to be Alex Chalk.
Yes, Alex Chalk putting on his wall Spencer Percival, of course. Unlike America, where there have been four presidential assassinations, we've only had one prime minister to be assassinated. An infamous occasion when a constituent, disgruntled constituent, waited in the Commons lobby and went and shot him. And Alex Chalk has chosen as a picture of this to hang up in his wall, and sort of perhaps a worrying portent of what's the fate to befall a sort of rising Tory star. But it was rather an interesting one. And I think what is telling is how often ministers and shadow ministers do select things that basically match their interests, either their subject matter or where they're coming from. And so Rachel Reeves also has selected a piece of suffragette propaganda. So what a woman may be and not have the vote, you know, the sort of famous one where women are depicted doing all sorts of achievements in the early 1910s and not having the vote. And I think that sort of representation of some of the motivating factors behind her politics as well.
Manveen, who do you have on your wall? Did you have peculiar pinups?
No, I can't say. I feel like very boring now. I was more intrigued by Michael Gove and Grant Shapps, though, who had nothing.
Massive pictures of themselves, probably.
Themselves, Margaret Thatcher, and the Queen, probably.
Yeah. Well, they've all got a picture of the Queen. What about you? What about you, Matthew?
I had a large poster of my journalistic hero, Matt Chorley. No, I didn't.
Not that much younger than me.
I think it's great. You know, there's this. You know, we've gone through this phase. There's a real sort of penny-pinching culture in politics now. You know, you see that they've spent 20p on paperclips and all the rest of it. Yeah. And I think this is good. I think, you know, the government art collection, you know, they buy up a lot of sort of rising stars, you know, they buy sort of Tracy Emmons, and I think it's good. You know, I think it's right that the state, you know, shows these things in their MPs' offices.
And it gets rotated back. James, what would you have, having looked into the art collection?
Well, I mean, very nicely, the government art collection actually, a couple of weeks ago, had a tour for some journalists behind the scenes because they're planning to make it public. And it's a great sign because obviously, I think only about a third of the artwork is ever on public display and they're always rotating collections. And I was really struck by one thing the curator said to me, which is that when ministers are deciding what to use to hang in their offices, it's not just the artwork themselves, it's about the history of that particular artwork. Because, of course, these paintings are taken all around the world to embassies across different parts of Britain. High commissions and embassies, etc. And also it's about the stories behind them. And so some ministers, for instance, would love to have a picture that once hung in Margaret Thatcher's office when she was a Secretary of State or Prime Minister. And so I think, but my personal one, I mean, I saw a really immense portrait of Queen Victoria, which is about sort of 11 foot high. And I really like the kind of, quite a grand impression. I think there's a bit of power play in ministerial selections going on. So a few years ago, I did a similar story and Gavin Williamson has selected Oliver Cromwell, a picture of Oliver Cromwell to hang in his office, which I thought was rather striking and always I remembered that detail.
James, I could see over your shoulder on the Zoom, you've got a framed bar chart.
I didn't realise. Yes, that is Sales and Spectator. Sorry, that is not a flex, I promise.
You know. Oh, it's Sales and Spectator. Okay, fine. It's not your own personal Twitter following.
No. Okay. Oh, God, no. This is
pay rises.
They don't monitor my progress that closely, hopefully.
It's your Monzo bank account screen grab. Matthew Holhouse from The Economist there, and of course Manveen Rana from Stories of Our Times. And you can catch Manveen on the Stories of Our Times podcast, One Story Told in Depth, every day, wherever you get your podcasts from. Up next is The Political Editors with Philip Webster.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast now. It's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
I don't think that other people in the world would share the view that there is mounting chaos.
Where there is discord, may we bring harmony.
We're all right!
It is time to put up or shut up.
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
This is a decisive moment for the world economy.
Now the decision has been made to leave, we need to find the best way.
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
I have been repeatedly assured that there was no party.
Growth, growth, and growth.
Some mistakes were made.
Half a century of politics told by the people who wrote the first draft of history for The Times. This is The Political Editors. On this episode, Philip Webster, the longest-serving political editor from 1992 to 2010. On the rise of Tony Blair, the fall of Gordon Brown, and being taken hostage at gunpoint with Neil Kinnock.
I'd made it my business to make myself known to Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, and I know they both did trust me. Sometimes Blair shook his head and said, I wish I hadn't trusted you. It was easily the tensest situation I'd ever been in after writing a story, because had I been wrong, probably wouldn't be talking to you now, Matt. So we were locked up and treated as if we were criminals, and led by Neil Kinnock, we sang Jerusalem, and the soldiers patrolled round and round the hut with their guns while we prayed for rescue.
What a time to become political editor. In 1992, Labour on the march to power, and then they weren't. John Major, the man who wasn't going to win anything, suddenly wins a surprise election, and you're right in the thick of it as political editor of the Times.
Absolutely. It was a wonderful time to take over. I'd been heavily involved covering the fall of Thatcher. But yes, the shock victory for John Major. It became clear in the last week of the 92 election that there was a chance. I remember going to watch Neil Kinnock speak in Blackburn and was standing at the back with Glenys Kinnock, who I knew well. Obviously, I knew Neil Kinnock well. And he just wasn't firing. Everybody expected him to be prime minister within a few days. And I said to Glenys, what's wrong with Neil today? And she said to me, he's worried. We're not absolutely sure we're breaking through. And she turned out to be quite right. So we were into that period of John Major taking over and then hitting trouble almost straight away. Black Wednesday within months, the party in total revolt. Sleaze started coming out everywhere.
I have made it clear from the very outset that these matters must be properly examined. Why else would I have set up the inquiries? Many people criticised me for doing so and said, why have you done this? You could have brushed it aside into after a week of parliamentary difficulty and it would all have gone away. I didn't do that. And why didn't I do that? Because I happened to care about the reputation of Parliament in the short term and the long term.
He was having the roughest time possible. And it was the most miserable 5 years for John Major and the Tories to endure, during which time, of course, Blair and Brown were just building up their plans for leadership and for government.
At what point did you think, OK, these are the guys I need to get in with? Did you spot them, because you were around Parliament for such a long time, you know, when they first became MPs in the 1980s? Was it when they got onto the front bench? When did you realise that these are the politicians you needed to get to know?
I think I'll be quite honest with you here, Matt. It was when Peter Mandelson told me, these are the two guys you need to be watching. and Peter told me a lot of things that were right over the years. I knew Peter very well. He was director of communications. And it was quite obvious that at that time he saw in Blair and Brown, who both came in 1983 together, Labour's route back to power.
Who is best? Who will play best at the box office, who will not simply appeal to the traditional supporters and customers of the Labour Party, but who will bring in those extra additional voters that we need in order to win convincingly.
It's really interesting, the Peter Mandelson question, because almost every politician thinks that they would be a better leader. Do you think there was any point where Peter Mandelson thought he could be the man to be the front man of this modernised Labour Party? It's interesting that he always seemed to have an idea of what it should be and opted for Blair as the right person to deliver it, rather than pushing himself.
Absolutely. I think he, more than anyone, knew that he would never be the person to do it, but he wanted to be the person to engineer the leader of New Labour. He knew he wasn't the kind of guy who was ever going to get the loyalty from the membership that would be required and then from the voters. But he certainly knew in his own mind what Brown first, there's no doubt, he saw Brown, first of all, as a potential leader, but then Blair, after they'd done a few years working together, he saw in Blair the guy who would take Labour to victory. As it turned out, he took them to three victories.
And you pulled off quite a clever trick, if you like, by being friends with both the Blair camp and the Brown camp, which as the time passed when they were in government after winning in 97, became increasingly important. How did you manage to pull that off rather than being seen as, you know, a Blairite reporter or a Brownite reporter and getting the titbits that came with that?
Well, I knew the dangers of being seen to be in with one side or the other. And therefore, it was always my aim to be trusted by both sides. Now, it so happened that I was very, very friendly with two of the leading figures on either side, in the sense that Ed Balls was a lifetime friend. We come from the same city of Norwich. We support the same football team. We'd always been close friends. We played a lot of football together. He's a lot younger than me, you'll quickly say, but we played in the same football team for quite a long time. And Alistair Campbell, a very good friend. He'd been in the lobby with me. We grew up knowing each other as young journalists in the lobby. So I know I was trusted by both sides. I'd made it my business to make myself known to Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. And I know they both did trust me. Sometimes Blair shook his head and said, I wish I hadn't trusted you. But I'm glad to say if I run into them now, which I do occasionally, it's always very friendly.
Okay, let's talk about some of those things you alluded to. Peter Mandelson and the euro, it's hard to imagine now in a post-Brexit age for lots of people that the big debate that once dominated British politics was about whether or not we would join the euro. And Tony Blair wanted to, Gordon Brown didn't. And you spent probably many hours you wish you could get back chronicling the ins and outs of that debate.
Yes, it was an amazing period in 97. Blair had come on, able to do anything, really, he felt. And he, I think, saw the possibility of going into the euro early in his term. The FT ran a story in August of 97 saying that Blair was on the point of launching a move to get Britain into the euro. And when that story dropped from the Financial Times that night, I rang a certain source who was the football friend that I mentioned to you earlier and said, what do I do with this? He said, if I were you, I wouldn't follow it. From that moment on, I knew there was a hell of a story around, because if Blair wanted to go in, quite clearly, Brown didn't. You know, this might be a story that either ended up with us going into the euro or Gordon Brown resigning. So I set about trying to get that out into the open. And I did it in a very strange way. I persuaded Ed Balls, but mainly Charlie Whelan, who was then Gordon's press spokesman, to get Gordon to do an interview with me on a Friday afternoon when, knowing what I knew, I'd put questions that I thought might well be able to get me to a point where I could write that we were not going to go in the euro without a fight. And the words he came out with were enough for me to write that Brown and Blair were not going to go into the euro in the first term of a Labour government. And that was a market-moving story, if it were right. It was a market-moving story if it were wrong. And the story came out on the Saturday morning. I did the interview on a Friday. Alistair Campbell was aware of the interview, but again, he didn't know what was going to be said. Blair tried in vain to find Alistair when the first edition of the Times dropped. Charlie Whelan, as we know, had placed himself in the Red Lion in Whitehall.
Oh dear, you know, I don't normally get calls off Tony Blair. So I went outside the pub, found a little private spot. And,
so you did at least put your drink down to take the call from Tony Blair?
Well, no, I might have had my spritzer in my one hand. But, you know.
When contacted by other journalists, he merely said, Phil Webster is a very good journalist, and put the phone down. So the story ran, and it's up on my wall at home. Blair rules out membership of the single currency. And there it was. Saturday morning, I get a call at home from the said Mr. Mandelson saying, Philip, over the years, you've spoken to me a lot. And when you've spoken to me, what you've written has been right. You will find that what you wrote today will be wrong. And talk about getting a chill going down the back of your neck. And I'm thinking, oh, my God. And it was 10 days before Brown himself stood up in the House of Commons to confirm the story that I'd written that Saturday morning.
Barring some fundamental and unforeseen change in economic circumstances, making a decision this Parliament to join is not realistic.
And to his credit, Peter Mandelson came up to me in the lobby that morning. I was down there at about 11:30. He said, Phil, you're going to find that your story is being stood up this afternoon by Gordon. I sort of knew it was, but it was nice to hear it from Peter Mandelson as well. It was one of those, it was easily the tensest story or the tensest situation I'd ever been in after writing a story, because had I been wrong, probably wouldn't be talking to you now, Matt. You know, it was not a story to get wrong. The markets hated it, of course. And when my story appeared on the Saturday and the markets opened on the Monday, Gordon Brown was at an event at the Stock Exchange, as it happened. And as he switched on this brand new system in the Stock Exchange, everything went red. And that were the markets falling. So I think Gordon must have thought, what have I done? What have I done?
You did do a good trade in market-moving interviews, Phil. That one was at the very early days of the new Labour government. You then did one, you were on the golf course, as you often were, I think, on the golf course, the 14th hole, and you got a phone call. Would you go and do an interview with Tony Blair, which accidentally or deliberately ended up hastening his departure from power?
Yes. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that the purpose of the interview was to elongate his stay as Prime Minister. It was the last day of August in 2006. He'd already said he would go, but the Brownites just couldn't wait any longer. They wanted to get their man in straight away. Yes, I was on. I was at a Sheringham golf course in Norfolk, and I got the call from David Hill. Can you come down tomorrow and interview the Tony? And I said, yeah, sure. And I'd fully expected to be given the story that the forthcoming conference that September, so just a few weeks later, was going to be his last. And as I walked into Chequers, and really no fripperies, I thought, I'll get straight to it. So, you know, is the conference going to be your last one, Prime Minister? Why on earth are you asking that? Phil, he used to call me Phil. Why on earth are you asking me that? And I said, well, there's been a hell of a lot of speculation that it will be your last. And he said, well, it's certainly not the case. And no, the next conference wouldn't be his last. And I must have asked that question 8 or 9 times. I could see David Hill, who was watching the interview, and Jonathan Powell. Even my friend, Mr. Riddle, I could feel was feeling slightly uncomfortable at the number of times I kept asking the same question. And Blair himself, who's got an extraordinary patience, finally said, Phil, I think this one's the last time, don't you? And said, look, I'm not going. My successor will be given ample time. And I thought, my God, that's a better story than the one I thought I was going to get. And
basically, all hell then broke loose with people who thought he was going to go, suddenly enraged that Tony Blair was still planning to hang on.
Yeah. What happened then was the story appeared. Blair defies party over leaving date was the splash headline in the Times. Over in Birmingham, a number of Brownites were having a meal. It became the Balti House plot. And in the days that ensued, one front bencher after another resigned the government, saying they no longer wanted to serve Tony Blair. And within a few days, he did a stand-up interview for, I think, Sky, in which he, yes, said it would be his last conference. So it was an interview that precipitated his fall, I think.
The truth is, you can't go on forever. That's why it's right that this is my last conference as leader.
And then obviously, having given his successor, as he promised, enough time, were you surprised, having seen the rise of Gordon Brown as a backbencher, then a frontbencher, then as Chancellor, seen him up close so much, were you surprised then that someone who'd hankered after the job of Prime Minister for so long seemed to struggle in it?
Yeah, I didn't think he'd have as rough a time as he did. But in my view, he took the job far too late. By then, 3 terms of Blair, and it was almost in the same position as Major after 3 terms of Thatcher. The country was beginning to tire of Labour. Had he done what he was advised to do and gone for a very, very swift election, if you remember, Matt, there was a foot and mouth outbreak in 2007, not long after Brown took over. He was deemed to have handled it extremely well. He was in the honeymoon period of his leadership, and he was very popular. Gordon Brown is not a gambler, but had he gambled and gone for it then, I think he probably would have won. But instead, we had 3 years of trouble. You know, we had the banking collapse, everything. Although he was again deemed to have handled that reasonably well, the country was not in a mood to re-elect Labour again in 2010. I've heard a lot of people say that if Blair and Brown had carried on in the same jobs, they might well have got another term. But that's something we'll never know.
So your time as political editor sort of ended with a messy Labour government, economic turmoil, heralding a decade or more of a Tory Prime Minister in Downing Street, which actually is how you started. You started in Westminster in the early 1970s as a press gallery reporter. Take us right back to that time, and how much did the job, not just the politics, but how much did the job change? Because you were there for such a long stretch in terms of the technology, your access to politicians, and the way you went about reporting on politics at the time.
The technological changes in my time were massive. The biggest of all, of course, was the way I got my copy across to the office. For years and years and years, wherever I was in the UK, covering by-elections, travelling with the Prime Minister, I had to find a phone. And I remember with Margaret Thatcher in the 1983 election, I was on her battle bus, and we were getting a bit fed up. We'd been on this bus for, seemed like, weeks, and we didn't see much of her. in terms of talking to us. And one Friday afternoon, her staff said, OK, we're going to Newbury Racecourse. The Prime Minister will give you a full rundown on how she sees the forthcoming G7. And a platform had been erected. She stood up there as if she was making a speech to several thousand racegoers. In fact, there were about 30 journalists. And she came out with a lot of rather aggrandizing stuff about how she was now the longest serving leader and she would have a big influence at the forthcoming GA. We rather mischievously saw this as Thatcher decides to conquer the world type story. We thought we'd got some good stuff. But we, of course, 83, no mobile phones. What do we do? So we persuaded our bus driver, please, driver, can you stop at Reading and we'll jump out of the bus and try and find some phones. And that's what happened. He pulled up. He's a rather gruff driver. And he said, you've got half an hour. And if you're not back here in half an hour, you'll have to find your own way home. And we jumped out of the bus and just ran and ran and ran. I was pretty fast. I got to the station. I knew there'd be phones there. I phoned my copy over, you know, Thatcher to take over the world, and ran back. About four of us made it. And we then pleaded with the driver to wait for the rest, and he wouldn't. And he went, drove back to London. And most of the guys had to find their own way back on the train, having filed their copy. So it's just one example of the madness that you had to go through in those days. Once with Neil Kinnock in the African bush, we'd got the most wonderful story when we'd landed in the wrong airstrip in Zimbabwe, and there were three or four young soldiers there with Kalashnikovs. They didn't look old enough to have guns. There we were with the red-haired leader of the opposition. He was wearing a bomber jacket, and he was swearing his head off and expressing fury at the way his traveling party, his wife, and press officers were being treated, as well as the way we, the journalists, were being treated. And they couldn't understand a word. Even if they could have spoken English, I don't think they'd have understood much of what Neil Kinnock was saying. So we were locked up and treated as if we were criminals. And led by Neil Kinnock, we sang Jerusalem in this hut. And the soldiers patrolled round and round the hut with their guns while we prayed for rescue. And after a couple of hours, by then it was getting dark, we saw some lights coming down the mountain. And it was the British High Commissioner's welcoming party, which had been at the correct airstrip, not the one that we landed at. Uh-huh. And I'll never forget when he arrived and apologized to Neil Kinnock for the way we'd been treated and held up. So I heard this wonderful story, Kinnock held at gunpoint in the African bush, which was in my head, and I couldn't wait to file it. But what did I file it with? There we were, stuck in the middle of nowhere in Zimbabwe. We took a decision amongst, there were only 12 of us, and we said, look, we can't file. There's no way of filing. Let's every man for himself when we get to the hotel. And we went to a place called Inyanga. And again, the first people off the bus were the people who got the phones. And that was the only way of getting the story across. Today, it would have been a mobile phone job. That's the big thing that changed in my time.
I just want to ask you, during your time at the Times, you covered, what, seven prime ministers? I mean, you had nine editors in that time, so I don't know what that says about journalism or politics. Did you feel like you became friends with any of those prime ministers? And is that a problem if journalists become too close?
There is a problem, I think, if you become too close. I wouldn't say I was friends with any of them. I mentioned Ed Balls. There's no doubt that he was a friend, but he was a friend before he got anywhere near Gordon Brown, and he remains a friend today. I mean, I became very friendly in his early days with John Major. He came in 1979, so he was an up-and-coming backbencher when I took my first steps in the lobby in 1981, and I made friends. He became a contact, but enough to be able to ring up on a Sunday, you know, the game, Matt, and say, look, what do you think is going to happen this week? You know, what do you think will happen with this bill or that? But the higher the MP goes up the greasy pole, the less easy it is to have those kind of friendly relationships. And you know that you're soon going to be writing stories, material that they're just not going to like. You can't afford to treat them as bosom friends. You can have a friendly relationship with them. I certainly had very friendly relations with Major, Blair, Brown, and David Cameron. There's no doubt about that. I'm not ashamed to say that. But were they close friends? Of course not. But they were people who I could ring up and have a conversation with, and probably could today.
And that was Philip Webster on an extraordinary career reporting politics for The Times. Of course, you can read all the latest political news from The Times. Just go to thetimes.co.uk and subscribe right now. And if you want to read some of the stories we've been discussing with the political editors, go to thetimes.co.uk/archive. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com